It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up, we'll talk to a tropical storm expert about Hurricane Patricia, which is set to hit Mexico today as the largest recorded hurricane in history. First, it's time for our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup. The Wisconsin Department of Transportation and Governor Walker are asking to borrow $200 million this year to pay for road projects. Some Republican lawmakers are pushing back on the request. Also this week, both houses of the state legislature passed bills changing the state's John Doe law. A government accountability board and campaign finance policies are still out there. Joining us now is Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett Central Wisconsin Media. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, a lot, as I said, in the state legislature this week. First up, Governor Walker has signed a bill that will change those John Doe investigations. So what exactly changes here? What's going to be different?
So John Doe investigations can no longer, by law in Wisconsin, as of Walker's signing, be used for political corruption investigations. They can be used for sort of major felonies for murders, but no more investigating politicians under these John Doe probes.
And both sides felt strongly about this one. Supporters said, hey, the way John Doe's have been done, they're secretive, tyrannical, harsh police tactics. Opponents say, hey, this is a special privilege for politicians, exempting them from this. Was this pretty heated argument over the course of this week?
Sure. Well, I mean, yeah, as you might imagine. So Walker himself was the subject of two such probes in his relating to his campaigns for governor. And so you might say, and some people have said, that there's a sort of a whiff of sour grapes in this in the whole affair. The Republicans point to, as you say, the secretive nature of these John Doe investigations, and this is something that everyone can relate to too. There is something unsettling about the ability of judges to issue gag orders to people who are being investigated. So your house is raided, but you're not allowed to say anything about what happened. And some of the secretiveness of it did rub some people the wrong way. Even there's a political motive, but there is something at least unusual about that.
So the John Doe thing, the change, is passed and signed. Now, the Government Accountability Board, and this is a related story, the Assembly passed a bill that would overhaul that, end it, in effect, split it into two different boards. Passed the Assembly. What happens next there?
Yeah, so it passed the Assembly. This has been a subject of a lot of discussion, and critics say it's going to weaken the state's ability to investigate political corruption or election misdeeds. This bill now goes to the Senate. I did notice it is sort of interesting. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald this week was quoted saying that he saw it as not a slam dunk in the Senate. So who knows? I'm not sure. Sure. It feels to me like something that has a lot of Republican support. Governor Walker is a strong supporter of this proposal. So, but it sounded like there might be some changes made in the Senate. I would it will be interesting to see. I would be surprised if some form of this bill does not ultimately become law.
Now, given a Republican majority there, that would changes or opposition would have to come from at least a few Republicans
pretty
for
much.
It not to pass.
Yeah, and I haven't heard of a lot of that, but maybe there's stuff going on behind closed doors.
And then the third part of this big change in our election and ethics laws, campaign finance laws, doubling, I think, the limit for individual donations, changing campaign coordination laws. This also has passed the Assembly. This vote went a little differently than usual. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there were some theatrics on this one. The Democrats, one by one, when it came time to vote, stood up and recused themselves from the vote, saying that they could not ethically vote on it because they had a personal financial stake in the law. That was, the outcome was the same. The bill was going to pass unanimously. It passed unanimously because the Democrats did not vote. It was going to pass on party lines one way or the other, but that was a way of dramatizing the strong feelings and the principles that Democrats say are at stake.
And over-dramatizing, according to the leader of the Republicans in the Assembly, Robin Voss.
Sure, yeah. He said he had never been more disappointed in the minority party than he was at this stunt. The bill itself, the campaign finance limits, I mean, it is worth saying individual contribution limits in Wisconsin are actually fairly low, $1,000 for state Senate candidates and $500 for assembly candidates. So so doubling those. Now, governor has more. It's $10,000 for a governor and other sort of state-level offices. But that is, you know, for what it's worth, it's not that, that doubling that brings it so out of sync with other places. Arguably, the bigger deal in the law is explicitly permitting coordination from outside issue groups, these issue advocacy groups, which raise unlimited money and they're not required to disclose their donors. And so, we've seen in Wisconsin elections a lot of spending by national conservative groups, Americans for Prosperity, or whatever, even on the level of local races, like we saw it in county board seats up in the Northwoods. And so the idea is that this bill would give more clout to that kind of spending, and that feels dramatic.
Talking to Rob Metzer from the Wausau Daily Herald in our weekly roundup of Wisconsin political news. Let's hit the road now, Rob. The State Department of Transportation, Governor Walker, wants state lawmakers to approve $200 million in borrowing, for starters, this year, to get some road projects back on track. So what's the argument for this borrowing request?
Yeah, so here we are again. This is the same issue that was that became a flashpoint in the budget process, and they're still working on it. The idea is that we have from the Department of Transportation the list of projects that will be delayed under current funding. The argument for doing the borrowing is that rates are pretty low right now, and that going forward with the projects saves the state money in the long run from it, that there's just going to be more deterioration. So the argument goes if they don't proceed, and also that having good infrastructure helps the state's economy overall.
In the category of things that aren't a slam dunk for Republican lawmakers, this one has been at the top of that list. Why are we seeing a pushback from some Republicans?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, it's borrowing. It's taking on more state debt. And so that's, you know, Senator Alberta Darling and some others, conservative Senate, don't, you know, that is not a priority for them, or it is a priority to prevent that for them. So an interesting thing may be at play. This is a possible case where minority Democrats and the minority party may actually have some influence, because if this or some version of this plan is going to go forward, they may need some Democratic votes.
And finally, Paul Ryan, Wisconsin congressman, has announced that he will run for Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, getting thumbs up from key players in the Republican caucus there. What got him there this week from last week? Extreme reluctance, I think, would be a fair way to put it.
Sure. Well, you know, it's been interesting to watch this play out. So he had a list of requirements and sort of a way of expressing what he would and would not do in the speakership. And you know, there are some technical procedural things, some stuff to do with, you know, wanting time with his family, not wanting to travel around to fundraisers all the time. But also mainly seeing it as important to have a unified Republican Party. And he didn't get the formal endorsement of the sort of hardline Freedom Caucus, but he got enough a supermajority of support that it sounds like it's going to happen.
Is there a timeline on when this vote would happen and he would become the speaker?
Yeah, you know, he just announced, I don't know it. I'm sure that they wanted to, I don't know that. I really don't know the answer. He just announced that he formally announced his candidacy for speaker today.
And looking ahead, assuming he does get it, he would, as I understand, be the highest ranking Wisconsinite ever in U.S. government. Does this would this have an effect, do you think, on how he represents his own district?
Yeah,
he's got
kind
this
of
leadership spot.
The highest ranking Wisconsinite with kind of the worst job in government, right?
Right.
The you know, it's not like it used to be, right? There aren't earmarks and arm twisting and the ability to bring home a bunch of bacon for your home district. So I think it's an open question. I mean, Eric Cantor was a member of House leadership who was voted out in a just last year. year or whenever that was. And it was precisely for the reason that his constituents thought he was, that they didn't see a benefit to him being in the leadership. So it's, you know, it's, I think that people like having somebody who's high profile, and there's certainly a lot of goodwill for Paul Ryan throughout the Republican Party. But does it help his district? That's a bit of a, I don't know that it necessarily does.
What does it mean for Wisconsin that we keep having these high-profile national things? The Governor Walker running for president, Paul Ryan for vice president, now speaker. All eyes are on our Senate race for control of the Senate next year. Does it feel a little different reporting in a state that's the center of all attention?
Sure, it feels like we're the center of attention, as we should be, right? This is where we have interesting people. There's interesting things happening.
Rob, thanks as always.
Hey, thank you very much.
That's Robert Mentzer with the Wausau Daily Herald, helping us recap the biggest stories around the state for our Wisconsin News Roundup. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Hurricane Patricia is the largest hurricane ever recorded in the Western Hemisphere. It's in the process of hitting the western coast of Mexico. It was a tropical storm early on Thursday, but quickly became a Category 5 hurricane with 200-mile-per-hour sustained winds. Some areas in Mexico are expecting up to 20 inches of rain. We understand wind gusts of 245 miles an hour. Joining us for the latest on the storm is Jeff Masters, Director of Meteorology at Weather Underground. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, Rob.
Well, tell us about this hurricane. I understand it's in some ways off the charts. If we had higher categories, this might be a Category 7, much less Category 6 or 5.
Yeah, Category 5 winds start at about 160 miles per hour, and this storm peaked out at 200 miles per hour. So that's 40 miles per hour above the threshold for Category 5 status. And it's right at the bottom of the scale for an EF5 tornado, which is the strongest kind of tornado. If you remember the damage from the Joplin tornado back a few years ago, basically those 200-mile-per-hour winds mowed down a half-mile-wide area across Missouri. This storm's got a 15-mile-wide area of those kind of winds.
As I understand it, with Thursday, when yesterday started, this thing was a tropical storm, and it progressed what sounds like very quickly to me. Is that unusual for something to switch from tropical storm to a high-category hurricane that quickly?
Highly unusual. We've only seen two other storms in the Western Hemisphere that intensified that quickly. One was Hurricane Wilma back in 2005, which was the strongest hurricane ever observed in the Atlantic. So this storm has been a record breaker.
And why? Why do we think it made such a quick progression?
We don't understand all the reasons why. I mean, the conditions that were in place for this storm to intensify were, quote, perfect. We had very warm ocean waters, about 87 Fahrenheit. We had very light winds aloft, which helped the storm maintain its integrity and its vertical alignment. And we had a lot of moisture in the atmosphere, more than 80% relative humidity. And now all those factors are very helpful for a hurricane to get going. But we've seen those kind of factors in place before for other storms, and yet they haven't done this. So there's some unknown things going on here that we don't understand, leading to this sort of remarkable intensification.
We've heard a lot about El Nino this year being a big factor in weather along that coast and probably affecting us here in Wisconsin for that matter. Has El Nino played a role in making Hurricane Patricia as intense as it is?
Absolutely. El Nino brings a lot of warm waters to the eastern Pacific where this hurricane is. And you increase the odds of a powerful hurricane when you have warmer than average waters. Now, we can also potentially blame global warming for those warmer waters. They would not have been that warm without the global increase in ocean temperatures that we've seen. They're at near record levels this year.
As I understand it, with climate change, it's hard to say we're going to take this one event and say it was caused by climate change. But the climate change, those higher temperatures you mentioned, does it make this kind of more intense hurricane more likely?
You load the dice in favor of more extreme storms when you heat up the oceans. And our computer models have consistently shown that over the coming decades, we do expect the strongest hurricanes to get stronger. And it's just a matter of time before we see a significant signal in the noise. I mean, there's a lot of natural noise, and there aren't enough of these strong storms, you know, to tell if they're increasing in number. But I think in a few decades, it'll become obvious.
Talking to meteorologist Jeff Masters with Weather Underground about Hurricane Patricia closing in on Mexico's coastline right now. One small saving grace, as I understand it, this is a very intense hurricane, but the area of the highest intensity is not as big as some hurricanes. Am I describing that correctly, Jeff?
Yeah, you are. It's a moderate-sized hurricane. and it's hitting a portion of the Mexican coast that isn't super heavily populated, I think it's going to miss Puerto Vallarta, the resort town that's a little bit to its north. And it's also missing Guadalajara, which is inland a bit. But still, it's going to be a billion-dollar-plus disaster for Mexico.
Talk about the kind of damage this kind of intense hurricane could do. I know that's part of how the different categories of hurricane are described. What kind of damage could we see in the worst-hit areas?
There's three components to the damage. Probably the worst damage potential from this storm is going to be wind damage because they are such extreme winds. I mean, they're down to 190 miles per hour right now, but that's still, you know, EF4 tornado scale winds. They're going to shred whatever structures are in its path unless they're reinforced steel concrete. Now, the storm surge is another big concern. Whenever you get winds this strong, they push a huge mound of water up onto the shore. And we're expecting a storm surge somewhere around 15 feet affecting the coast here of Mexico. So that's going to wash away a lot of the structures near the shore. And the third damage factor, which is usually the biggie for Mexican storms, is rainfall. There's a lot of mountains right by the coast. They're going to intercept the winds of the storm and wring out a lot of water. So we're thinking a lot of 10 to 15-inch rain amounts going to cause flash flooding, mudslides, and so on. Now, one thing to keep in mind is Mexican civil defense is among the best in the world. They're very, very good at reducing death tolls from these sorts of hurricanes. And if this storm were to hit, say, the U.S., the death toll would have been much higher.
We're less prepared, you're saying, than Mexico would be.
Absolutely. The Mexican authorities don't mess around. I mean, they move in, they let the residents know, and the residents react. When they're told to evacuate, they get out. The U.S., yeah, we're kind of like, we don't really want to go.
I wonder about warning time, though, because this thing progressed so quickly from tropical storm to Category 5, so only really a day or so to turn this around. Is that unusual to have that little warning time on a major hurricane like this?
Yeah, that's highly unusual. When the storm formed, the forecasts were for it to get to Category 2 strength, so they already had a pretty good idea that a significant hurricane was coming. But the fact it went from tropical storm to Category 5 in just 24 hours, that's really hard for emergency managers to deal with because it means you've got to do a lot more mobilization than you expected to prepare for it.
And when they first figured out it was Category 5, how much wiggle room was there for the hurricane to turn and make it unclear at that point how wide an area should be evacuated?
This was a more predictable storm in its track than a lot of storms, particularly what we're used to in the Atlantic. Things kind of go haywire there a lot of times. So I don't think the situation was out of the ordinary that much as far as figuring out where it was going to go.
I understand sometimes in the past when hurricanes have hit, they also spawn tornadoes. Is that a concern as this one makes landfall?
Sure, they can always spawn tornadoes. This one's hitting far enough to the south that I don't think you're going to get the sort of situation where you generate tornadoes. Usually you need a little bit of jet stream action, which you don't get unless you're a lot farther north. Typically, it's the hurricanes that hit along the Gulf of Mexico shore or along the east coast of the U.S., which are much farther to the north, where you get that extra sort of interfering factor with the atmosphere that can help spin up tornadoes.
So what happens to the storm after the worst of the landfall is done? What will it do as it travels inland, as you see, into mountainous territory?
It's going to get shredded by the high mountains of Mexico, and it's going to be reduced to a remnant low that isn't going to have tropical characteristics anymore. But that remnant low is going to have a lot of moisture packed into it, and it's going to move into South Texas on Sunday and give them probably 2 to 4 inches of rain on top of the 2 to 4 they've already gotten today, and they're supposed to get a couple more tomorrow. So we're talking about a long-lasting, intense rainfall event for Texas. It's going to cause a lot of flooding, a lot of damage. Already is causing some damage. There's some high water rescues going on, flash flood emergencies being declared in Texas.
A scientific phrase I hadn't encountered until today, a theoretical maximum of intensity of a hurricane, of wind speeds, I guess because of the physics, the rotation of the earth, something like that, and that this might be close to as intense as a hurricane can be. Is that true?
It is true. The maximum potential intensity that a storm can reach is a function of the ocean temperature beneath it and then the instability of the atmosphere that the storm's embedded in. So if you've got a lot of warm, moist air near the surface, which is low density, and a lot of cold, dry air aloft, which is high density, that's an unstable situation, which makes strong updrafts in the thunderstorms, which can really drive the storm to be very intense. And if you looked at the maximum potential intensity charts for this storm, it said, yeah, it could reach 880 millibars, and this thing reached 879 millibars. So it achieved its maximum potential intensity, something that's very rare.
Thinking about the impact now on people there, you mentioned civil defense in Mexico swinging into action. Is this a thing where the international community, NGOs, relief organizations are getting ready, should be getting ready to provide a lot of help and quickly?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Anytime a hurricane of this magnitude hits, all the NGOs are prepared to respond.
And very briefly, are you going to be studying this in the months to come to see what we can learn about future hurricanes?
Always. I mean, we have a research plane in there right now, which is great, a NOAA Hurricane Hunter aircraft. Actually, I used to fly with the NOAA Hurricane Hunters, and that same plane is there now taking radar data, taking detailed measurements every few seconds. It's going to provide a great data set to study to see, you know, what exactly made this storm tick.
Jeff, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date today.
Okay, Rob, you're welcome.
That's Jeff Masters giving us the latest on Hurricane Patricia. It's set to hit Mexico today as the largest hurricane ever recorded. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. A new social network is trying to help older Wisconsinites to stay independent, stay in their own homes longer. The issue is looming for Wisconsin in particular. The state's elderly population is expected to double by the year 2040. And Wisconsin is one of the few states where there are more baby boomers than millennials. The new site is called ElderTree. Its design is based on feedback from older adults, family members, aging and healthcare professionals, and community groups. Here's an excerpt of some testimonials from older Wisconsinites who have used the site.
It's a support group. People share recipes. They share news about their life, vacations. But it's an emotional and a prayerful support group.
I don't feel so alone. I can talk with people who've gone through some of the same things that I have.
We have two guests with us now to talk about ElderTree. David Gustafson is an emeritus research professor of industrial systems engineering and director of the Center for Health Enhancement System Studies. David, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rob. I appreciate it.
Also with us, Scott Gatsky. He's director of dissemination for ElderTree. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, Dave, let's go to you first. Talk us through, what is ElderTree?
Well, ElderTree is a computer system that operates on computers designed pretty much for elders themselves. For instance, it doesn't use a mouse. It has a very large screen to make it easy to read, and things like that. So it's designed to be very, very simple and friendly to use. And there are a lot of different services that are on it, but when we worked with people in Waukesha and Richland counties and Milwaukee County, we found that a couple of things were really important. First, that older adults really, as they move further and further into aging, feel lonely and isolated, and really don't get out nearly as much as they did before. And we've been concerned that it's important to keep them in their homes and not have them use health services quite as much as they often do, because we want them to be healthier. And and so we've developed a ElderTree to do a variety of things, but basically intended to reduce loneliness and isolation, and in doing so prevent falls and reduce depression and things like that. I'm going to give you five quick examples of what's in ElderTree, although there are many more. For instance, one thing that people can do is go into a tips section where experts have left information about things like how to avoid falls. And people can go in there, can comment, can add their own things about what they do around the house to avoid falls, and engage in discussions around that. A second thing that's that exists is that people can join a variety of discussion groups where they talk, leave messages with for other older adults, and they can carry out various kinds of conversations. They could be talking about politics, they could be talking about religion, they could be talking about baking, or just anything that comes to mind. The third thing is that the system is set up to help older adults drive more safely. And so, for instance, one of the things that we know is that left-hand turns are very high-risk things for any driver to make. They're the primary cause of accidents in cars. And so the Elder Tree sets up routes for people to get from one place to another, and those routes minimize the number of left-hand turns that you'd have to make to make things safer. The fourth example would be that there are a number of ways in which the family can get engaged with the older adult. One, for instance, is simply by sharing photos or leaving messages, but they can also monitor how things are going with the older adult to make sure that everything is working well. And then finally, the Elder Tree, if the older adult wants, can collect information about how they're doing regarding their health, and soon be able to share that information with their doctors, especially if the patient is really struggling with a problem. So there are a lot of different services, but that gives you five examples of ways in which the system operates. It was designed by elders, for elders.
And Scott, part of your job, I know, is getting the word out, bringing people on board with Elder Tree. How are you doing that? How are you getting Wisconsin seniors using Elder Tree?
Yeah, exactly. Well, we spent some time in Waukesha. We had a community group there that came together from civic groups and the library and the schools and senior living facilities, and they really helped us kind of formulate a dissemination model, saying how best could we take Elder Tree into a community that's never heard about us. And what came out of that was a model that we've been testing, and now we're really working throughout the state. And the model is basically we go and connect with the library, civic groups, basically anyone that is serving older adults in the community, and we turn them on to Elder Tree and then try to get some groups of existing older adults using it. And what we find there is that generates some excitement, and then with each community being unique, they find some really amazing creative ways to use it and integrate it and get the word out. And the other way that's a big part of our plan to spread this throughout the state is through community administrators. And basically what that is, it's a local person who's kind of a volunteer champion for Elder Tree, who we do a little 30-minute training with them over the phone and on the computer, and then they have some administration rights for Elder Tree where they can activate user accounts and create custom groups for seniors in their community. A big part that our members tell us that they like about Elder Tree is that we have this personal touch to it. So a new person could go on eldertreewisconsin.com, click become a member, and create their account real quickly. But the last step is we actually give them a call and welcome them and just kind of verify their age, and then we activate their account. And so community administrators are also helping us do that function.
We're talking to Scott Gatzke and David Gustafson about Elder Tree. That's a new social network aimed at helping keep older Wisconsinites in their homes longer. And David, apart from the social connection and these direct services you talked about, there's some hope that because of this, people are going to have better health outcomes. How are you trying to help with that and figure out if it's working?
Well, in our first application of that is in Door County, where we're working with a healthcare system that serves about 70% of the older adults in the community. The healthcare system there up there is Ministry, and what we're doing is collecting information from patients about their health conditions. Most older adults have several chronic conditions. For example, they might have diabetes and they might have hypertension and things like that. And so each day and sometimes each week, Elder Tree will collect data about how the patient is doing. And if they are expressing, for instance, a lot of pain, or they're struggling with adhering to their medications, and they want their clinical team to know about it, then the computer itself will contact the physicians and the nurses that care for them, and share that information with them. I think it's important to point out, though, that nothing is done on the system without the older adults' approval, and they're the people that are in charge. We're going to see what's happened, but so far, in some very early tests, we're seeing pretty substantial reductions in people having to go to the doctor. A lot of improvement in feelings of sadness and loneliness and things like that. So we're pretty excited by the early results.
And Scott, watching some of the videos about Elder Tree, some of the people participating say, hey, I'm not a computer person. I was a little intimidated by the technology. David mentioned how this is streamlined a little from the usual computer, but how are you helping people make that leap into what's a new world maybe for some of them?
Absolutely. Part of what we're doing now in getting out into communities is, fortunately with this project, we have the time and resources to be able to come in and meet with older adults and actually take some time to do training on Elder Tree. So we meet with groups and do a walkthrough of the website and help them get started. And that's been a big part of it. I'm glad you chose the clips you did to start the interview, because the personal connection that those two individuals were talking about there, and the feeling that they're not alone and that there's a group of people out there, we hear that over and over again from folks who never thought a technology could affect their life in this way. A lot of these folks who had never had a computer, they only saw their grandkids using it and, moving at 100 miles an hour, and all they could think that, boy, there's no way I could do that. And Elder Tree has become kind of that first step for them that not only allows them to get some of the basic computer skills, but then now they're actually connecting daily with folks, around the state and in their local community.
We're talking to David Gustafson and Scott Gatzke about Elder Tree, a new social network designed to help keep older Wisconsinites independent, staying in their homes longer. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how this works? Have you tried it yourself? Love to hear from you, or maybe someone in your family has. What do you think should be included? What would be helpful for you, your family, in something like this? Call in at 800-642-1234. And what are the biggest challenges if you're a senior? Are there for staying in your own home? 800-642-1234 is the number. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our discussion now with David Gustafson and Scott Gatzke about Elder Tree. That's a new social network developed to help keep older Wisconsinites in their homes longer. You can join at 800-642-1234. If you're older, would you use Elder Tree? Have you been one of the people using it in its early stages? What should be included? What kind of challenges do you think it could help people meet? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller. Lee is with us in Madison. Lee, hi.
Hi. I am very happy there is a program like this. And I think it's a very good program, but what about the small towns like Boyd, Wisconsin, and Stanley, and Chippewa? And my brother lives out on the farm, and he doesn't have a computer. And I just was wondering, how can people find out about Elder Tree? I have a sister in Eau Claire, and she knows about computers, but I don't know if he would fight it or he would accept it. So
I hear you, Lee. I want to bring our guests in. A couple really good questions there. First of all, getting this into rural areas, small towns. Let's start with you on that, Scott. Is there an effort to bring this into smaller communities where maybe people are more isolated, more remote?
Absolutely. In fact, we find, you know, kind of stands to reason that some of the rural areas are some of our heaviest users of Elder Tree. But that was a great question from the caller. We've got the ADRCs, the Aging and Disability Resource Centers from around the state, have been very active in this and are very excited. We have over 30 counties that have expressed, you know, we want Elder Tree to come in, and we're at various stages of dissemination there. So your local ADRC office is one place to check. But to answer the question about accessibility, as you get in northern Wisconsin and areas, you know, internet access is an issue. For those that, you know, even don't have a computer at home, the great thing about Elder Tree is once you set up your account, you can access it from any computer. So at the library or if your senior center has a computer, those are all places where you can access it at your son or daughter's place. So those are possibilities.
Lee, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Kara now in Waukesha. Kara, hi.
Hi. This is Carol. I've been on Elder Tree for approximately 5 years now, and I love the tips because I think they're so helpful to anybody. And also, some of us from Waukesha are now close friends also, and I think that is great that you can get to know people personally also.
And Carol, you're saying you've met people that you didn't know before. These are new people you've met online, and now you're friends with them?
Right. In fact, we had a birthday party for two of them a couple of weeks ago, and there were six of us, and five I had not known before, one I had.
Carol, thank you so much for sharing your experience with Elder Tree. And David, is that something you hear a lot from people using it?
Yes, it certainly is. There are people who are maybe very sheltered and often places where there aren't a lot of other folks around, and this is giving an opportunity for those folks to, if you will, get to know others and to begin to share information and seek advice and seek support. And Yes, I would say of all the, we've been doing things like this for the last 25 years in areas before Elder Tree, things like cancer and asthma and things like that. And no matter where we do it or what we use it for, the vast majority of uses are in the discussion group, and it is giving information and receiving social support from other members of the group, and so it's a very powerful, important part.
Carol, thanks a lot for that call. Time for a quick call from Laura in Madison. Laura, hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks so much. I missed the beginning of your program, so I don't know if you covered this. I'm a person in transition in my life, and I would love the opportunity to live with an elderly person and do their cooking and cleaning and yard work and errands in exchange for free rent. Is that kind of match-up service part of what you do? And if not, you know, where could I hook up with that?
Laura, thanks for the call. Is there anything like that, connecting seniors with help, possible services out there? Scott?
Currently, we don't have that functionality built into it. But the in terms of the sharing information and people looking for things like that, that's done on Elder Tree. But to connect with the outside, we do have a resource page on Elder Tree. And if there's somebody out there that has a service to connect people wanting to provide services like the caller does with older adults, we'd love to hear from them because then we could put that resource on our page and be able to connect folks.
And Scott, I don't know if the resource page is the same thing as the bulletin board, but there is a bulletin board where people can post all sorts of things, ranging from recipes to events that are coming up and things like the caller mentioned. And so while it isn't explicitly set up for a matching service, you know, it can conceivably act as one.
Well, David, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. We deeply appreciate the opportunity.
And Scott, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
We've been talking to David Gustafson, Emeritus Research Professor of Industrial Systems Engineering, Director of the Center for Health Enhancement System Studies, and Scott Gatzke, Director of Dissemination for ElderTree. They're with us to talk about ElderTree. It's a new social network for older adults. Wisconsin is one of two dozen states that today filed a lawsuit against President Obama's plan to cut carbon dioxide emissions from the nation's power plants. That plan formally took effect this morning, and Governor Scott Walker quickly followed through on his threat to sue to try to stop that rule. Chuck Kurnbach reports on some of the expected legal arguments.
The president's climate change initiative, known as the Clean Power Plan, aims to cut CO2 emissions from existing power plants by about a third over the next 15 years. Governor Scott Walker has been promising that Wisconsin would be a part of a multi-state lawsuit against the rule, and yesterday in Milwaukee, Walker didn't hesitate to repeat himself.
Are you still going to sue on that?
Yes, it's a costly power plan that will cost tens of thousands of manufacturing jobs in the state, and we'll see upwards to close to 20% potential increases for ratepayers in the state. It's a costly power plan.
Walker even calls it a radical plan by the U.S. EPA, a characterization the Environmental Protection Agency says isn't true.
This year, the theme is air and energy, the path ahead for U.S. states.
Last week, UW-Madison professor Tracy Holloway welcomed hundreds of people to an annual energy summit. Carbon emissions and climate change were at the top of the agenda, and EPA Midwest Administrator Susan Hedman delivered the keynote speech. Hedman addressed the cost of clean power.
Clean power implementation plans will produce environmental and health benefits that far outweigh compliance costs.
In other words, Hedman says slowing down global warming would likely bring fewer costly storms and heat waves. She also says if power plants are cleaner, not as many people would have lung problems. Hedman says states can develop the implementation plans along three major existing building blocks, getting coal or oil-fired power plants to become more efficient, more plants can convert to cleaner-burning natural gas, and states can also help push renewable energy and energy efficiency. But well before next September, when Wisconsin and other states would have to file an implementation plan or request a two-year extension, the 24-state lawsuit filed today hopes to stop the rule. Madison attorney Todd Palmer has represented electric utilities and says the EPA has exceeded its authority.
The utility industry has dealt with a variety of Clean Air Act initiatives clearly authorized under the Clean Air Act. At no point that I'm aware of did this clean power plan idea 111D enter into that equation or be factored into the emission reductions that are demanded under those programs.
The Wisconsin Justice Department says states would have to regulate coal-fired power plants even though the EPA already does so, causing double regulation. State Attorney General Brad Schimmel also says states would have to restructure their electric grids and effectively require an illegal cap-and-trade program to bring down overall carbon emissions. Lawyers for green groups are ready to help the EPA defend the Clean Power Plan. Sean Donahue represents the Environmental Defense Fund. He says the federal rule does follow the Clean Air Act by prompting more of what utilities do now.
If you're one coal plant, you might reduce your emissions by purchasing a wind farm or a solar installation, still producing just as much power, but through a different mix of resources. Or you might invest in a natural gas plant, lower emitting.
We Energies has been converting this coal-fired power plant near downtown Milwaukee to natural gas, but the company is still hoping a federal appeals court in Washington, D.C. slows down the clean power plan. Chuck Kurnbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.